Everyone, welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Aubrey, and I'm joined today by both of my partners in podcasting.
Hello, hello.
Well, hey there. You seem rather cheery today, Dee. Anything going on?
I was hoping you'd ask.
Well, you weren't very subtle there.
All right. What is it, Dee?
Okay, so you know how often we talk about biotechnology, genetically engineered foods, and food security on this show, which, by the way, is awesome because we're all aware it's my favorite topic.
Yes, yes, it's Cleo's too. You both fangirl over these episodes a little too much.
All right, yeah, I guess we're all aware by now. Anyway, I just found out that after more than a decade of rigorous scientific testing and extensive research trials, golden rice is moving closer to the marketplace in the Philippines.
Oh, that's right. The IRRI submitted an application for a biosafety permit to the Department of Agriculture seeking approval to allow direct use of golden rice. I was hoping we could talk about this one of these episodes.
Love the current events talk, guys. But what's the IRRI besides a really mean tongue twister that I should have somehow tricked Daniela into saying?
All right, typical. The IRRI is the International Rice Research Institute. Who knew there was one? Seems like there's an international institute for everything. Anyway, if the application is successful and the biosafety permit is approved, then golden rice may finally find its way onto the dinner table of Filipino families.
So, for clarification, Daniela is enthusiastic about this because she's a food tech nut, but also because golden rice is a genetically engineered variety of rice created by Ingo Patricus, professor of plant sciences at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. The rice is fortified with beta-carotene, which can be converted into vitamin A within your body. And for this reason, putting it on the dinner tables of Filipino families may finally help address prevalent health problems there associated with vitamin A deficiency.
Gotta love when current events can be tied seamlessly into our episodes. So awesome, isn't it?
Very cool. Very true.
Yeah, actually, I have to admit, I was a bit nervous about what crazy thing you were going to bring up today, but this is actually relevant. Nice job. I'd even go as far to say I'm grateful you brought it up.
And why is that?
Because it's actually exactly what we're talking about today.
Today's episode is based on a debate that took place at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's conference in Verona, Italy, way back in April 2013.
It was called Food Safety, Security, and Defense: Focus on Technologies and Innovation. And the policy position paper we'll focus on today was written by Dr. Martina Newell-McLaughlin. It was titled Agricultural Biotechnology's Potential Contribution to Global Food Security and Stewardship of the Earth's Resources.
Awesome. Loving everything about today. Food security, biotechnology, and of course, Italy.
And if you're as passionate about these subjects as Daniela is over here, while you listen to today's episode, or even afterward, be sure to communicate with us on our social media channels. You'll find us on Twitter at ISGPForum and on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
So quick refresher on biotechnology and genetic engineering first, right?
Right. So biotechnology, or biotech for short, comprises the technologies that allow us to genetically engineer organisms. Genetic engineering, also called genetic modification, is the direct manipulation of an organism's genome or genetic code or DNA, however you like to think of it. This sometimes includes the transfer of genes within and across species boundaries to produce quote-unquote improved or novel organisms. You've heard of it with respect to plants like corn, I'm sure.
What's important to note, before we finish off this little recap, is that the end products obtained using both genetic engineering and conventional breeding are genetically identical. The only thing that's different is the technique used, and thus the amount of time required, to get to that end product.
And as Dr. Newell-McLaughlin pointed out, this speed thing is super important because in the coming decades, food and agricultural production systems must be able to respond to a number of transformative changes.
Changes such as a growing world population, more international competition, globalization, heightened demand for resources, increasing meat consumption in developing countries, and rising consumer demand for improved food quality, safety, nutrient content, convenience, and provenance. Okay, I think that's the full laundry list.
Exactly. A great challenge of our time is sustainability of the biosphere and figuring out our place in it. Can we learn how to meet our needs today without compromising the ability of future generations to meet theirs?
With the 7.5 billionth member of humanity having joined the planet this past April, achieving global food security sustainably is quite possibly one of the most important issues facing civilization and, by implication, the entire planet over the next 30 years. To meet the world's needs by 2050, it's estimated that 70% more food must be produced from less land and fewer inputs, meaning lessening our use of water, energy, fertilizer, and chemical pest controls for food.
And Dr. Newell McLaughlin urges that the state of our current global food reserves is of immediate concern. Actually, in 2012, the United Nations issued an unprecedented warning about global food supplies.
It noted that failing harvests in the United States, Ukraine, and other countries eroded global food reserves to their lowest level since 1974, when the world's population was much lower. World grain reserves are so dangerously low that another year of severe weather in food-exporting countries could trigger a major hunger crisis.
Right. So Dr. Newell McLaughlin argues that these new and innovative biotechnologies that could improve the operational efficiency of the global agriculture sector will be needed to ensure an ample supply of healthy food.
But these techniques could prove beneficial not just to developing countries. They could also aid in fighting food insecurity, ranging geographically from the food deserts of inner cities to the infertile areas of many regions.
Yeah, in this conversation, the food security of the developed world is often left out. And we get it. The food insecurities of the developing world are glaring and pretty hard to ignore, in many cases. But dramatic increases in the occurrence of obesity, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, and related ailments to more affluent countries are directly tied to food security. These are, of course, in sharp contrast to the chronic malnutrition observed in many lower-income countries. Obviously, both problems are practically begging for solutions.
Well, both sets of problems require a modified food supply, and the tools provided by biotechnology, while not the sole solution, may have a significant role to play.
Right. Both extremes are forms of malnourishment, one resulting from inadequate supply, and the other, in many but not all instances, from imprudent choices often influenced by economic considerations. In other words, McDonald's, as unnutritious as it is still cheaper than shopping at Whole Foods. A diet consisting of primarily McDonald's and the like results in malnutrition, just as a diet consisting of not enough food in general results in malnutrition.
I mean, yeah, because malnutrition is defined as both under and overnutrition.
So how is the human diet divvied up? Well, plant-based products actually comprise the vast majority of human food intake, either directly or even indirectly, because animals eat food made of plants. And this is the case irrespective of location or financial status.
And in some cultures, either by design or by default, as a result of poverty, plant-based nutrition comprises virtually the entire diet.
So this suggests that significant nutritional improvement could be achieved via modification of staple crops, which is exactly why the golden rice thing is an opportunity. It's a perfect example of Dr. Newell McLaughlin's argument.
It's been reported that incorporation of beta-carotene into rice cultivars and widespread distribution of this quote-unquote packaged technology in the seed could prevent 1 to 2 million deaths each year by alleviating vitamin A deficiency. Yet, despite the fact that this crop has been under consideration for more than a decade and it's been subjected to tons of risk assessments, it's still awaiting release from regulatory purgatory.
And this sounds like a lot of regulation restricting a lot of saved lives. And considering that one of the biggest concerns regarding the use of genetically engineered crops is potential environmental impacts, the debaters even wondered what environmental risks could possibly result from golden rice that would offset the benefit of preventing millions of agonizing deaths due to malnutrition.
But, like I said, as of late, we're in a waiting stage until we find out whether the safety permit is granted this time around in the Philippines.
So, turning the page from human health to environmental health, agricultural biotechnology, including advanced plant breeding and genetic engineering, has already helped farmers around the world boost their productivity and grow crops in more ecologically healthy fields, while simultaneously allowing much more efficient use of those resources that need to be scaled back, like we mentioned earlier.
Right. This technology allows for reduced land cultivation, which cuts down on greenhouse gas emissions, water runoff, soil erosion, and fuel consumption, which is a win-win-win-win, a quadruple win, a quin.
Quinning.
And on top of that, biotech also allows for improved pest control, higher yields on existing acreage, and reduced pressure to convert forests and wildlands into farmland, which I know speaks to all of my friends out there who are constantly worried about deforestation.
Of the 17 million farmers who grew genetically modified crops in 2012, more than 15 million, or nearly 90%, were in developing countries. And for the first time, developing countries grew a larger percentage of the world's global biotech crops than industrial countries, 52% versus 48%.
Biotechnology can speed up conventional breeding programs and may offer solutions where conventional methods fail, which is beneficial for growers, consumers, and the environment. The benefits experienced by larger scale farmers in both industrialized nations and less affluent countries are already considerable.
Right. Research by Brooks and Barfoot showed that from 1996 to 2011, biotech contributed to crop production increases valued at $98.2 billion and reduced the environmental footprint incurred by pesticides by more than 15%. Basically, their use kept 473 million kilograms of pesticides from entering the environment.
And insect-resistant maize also has a collateral effect. Less insect damage results in fewer infections from fungal molds, which in turn reduces mycotoxin contamination, a serious health hazard.
That's quite the chain reaction.
Likewise, insect-resistant BT maize has led to cumulative economic benefits over 14 years. Ready for the slew of numbers I'm about to throw at you?
Never. No, please. Never.
Okay, so between $3.2 and $3.6 billion in economic winnings have been associated with BT maize growth. And get this, $1.9 to $2.4 billion of this total has actually gone to non-BT growers through a halo or umbrella-like protective effect.
A 2005 paper from the Royal Society suggested that intensive high-yield farming on less land is actually better for wildlife than quote-unquote wildlife-friendly farming. Through increased yields, biotech is contributing to biodiversity conservation by saving 108.7 million hectares of land from being converted to agricultural production.
And in addition to the stable crops, the technology has also been used for some specialty crops. Virus-resistant papaya, developed using biotechnology, saved the papaya industry in Hawaii, as no natural resistance exists in the non-engineered varieties. And the use of new variants has also helped organic growers by reducing the reservoir of virus within the plants from which insects transmit the disease. It's kind of like herd immunity for plants.
Yeah, a similar scenario may actually be needed to save the Florida citrus industry and the California wine industry from refractory pathogens for which there are currently no known effective and sustainable control systems.
And none of us want our only domestic wine industry to fail, do we?
Definitely not. So, commercialization of biotechnology products should be just another step in a long history of human interaction with nature to meet societal needs, and as such, the same parameters of risk-based assessment should apply.
Genetic manipulation through breeding has a long history of safe use for crop improvement. And modern biotechnology simply extends those benefits through more precise methods. It offers an efficient and cost-effective means of producing high-quality food, feed, and fiber, as well as a diverse array of novel value-added products.
Unfortunately, as we mentioned before, disproportionate regulatory burdens placed on crops developed via biotechnology force reliance on older, less effective, and unsustainable crop improvement and production systems that will inevitably have a negative impact on food security.
Right, and that's not just a theory. Its effects are calculated. One example is the Fortuna potato. This savory spud contains two genes from a wild relative that confer resistance to late blight disease, which otherwise is a $5 billion problem.
Growing this potato means no need to spray fungicides, even organic approved copper sulfate.
Exactly, but the developer of the Fortuna potato is abandoning the European Union because it's not hopeful that it will win regulatory approval despite the potential benefits to growers and the environment.
While farmers in the EU can afford and continue to use fungicides, low-input farmers with few other alternatives could greatly benefit from crops that are genetically superior and deliver disease-resistance traits.
So, in regards to this conversation about regulation, Dr. Newell McLaughlin and the debaters had a few suggestions regarding a few policy areas, including the technical complexities, globalization, and intellectual property.
Liability issues, regulatory issues.
And of course, our favorite, consumer opinion and acceptance.
Right. So, first of all, let's start with the technical complexities. Technical and translational challenges must be overcome to enable introduction of desirable traits into crops. Adequate resources are needed to ensure cutting-edge science can be applied to crop improvement.
In addition, mechanisms should be put in place to facilitate translation from lab bench to farm field by anticipating downstream development, deployment, and commercialization requirements.
And here we naturally encounter the conversation of globalization and intellectual property. There's a negative perception of intellectual property ownership when it comes to seed technologies. This impression is fueled by a perceived enhancement of corporate power with possible negative impacts on employment or even small farms.
This should come as no surprise, given the wide public's verbal attacks on and concern over certain food and ag companies and their history of relationships with smallholder farms.
Dr. Newell McLaughlin argues that a certain amount of ownership in developing these seed technologies might be necessary, as innovation simply cannot occur without the ability to recover one's investment.
And we have to note, as it has been suggested, and it is worth considering, that to speed investment in R&D, mechanisms could be put into place to reduce intellectual property barriers and improve commercialization strategies.
But of course, in this amorphous area of commercialization and diffusion of technologies, public perception still adheres to fear of the unknown. At the moment, there are pretty misguided fears about added genes in biotech-derived products.
So I guess you could say this is a sector where people perceive entropy to reign supreme, huh?
I don't get it.
There's nothing to get. Dee, being the foreigner that she is, but sort of also not really, has just learned a new word and now won't stop using it. You're lucky you have yet to experience
I see. Well, okay. In any case, D, you could say public fear derives from any unknowns, perceived to be inherent in this field, although it's not an empirically justified fear.
Okay, guys, I have a joke. Ready?
All right.
Entropy just isn't what it used to be.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I really don't think you understand what that word means.
Wait, really? No way. I thought.
Yeah, we'll save the chemistry slash physics lesson for later.
Oh, I'm really sad now.
All right, so where were we? Right, so talking about liabilities and regulation and perception. So Dr. Newell McLaughlin argues, like you said, Aubrey, that the fears are not justified and that coexistence between different production systems requires reasonable regulation.
And beyond regulatory regimes being unreasonable, at the moment, worldwide regimes are also asynchronous and not science-based. Regulatory frameworks must be developed that ensure adequate protection of the consumer and the environment while not slowing innovations that enable deployment of beneficial technologies.
This effort to protect the consumer has been severely abused by misinformation campaigns attacking biotechnology. The movement against biotechnology has even been used as a marketing ploy. You know, you've seen the big names put non-GMO labels on their products that have no official certification.
This frustrates me so much when I go grocery shopping with a lot of friends. Companies really do use these labels just to capitalize on public fear and then profit off of it.
Yeah, so it's clear that a more effective communication strategy must be developed with scientists setting the agenda using evidence-based science and, of course, appropriate context.
Although we should recognize that the debaters did consider labeling as a way to increase transparency and therefore public perception.
That is true. You're right. And the discussion of labeling should only be. That is true. You're right. But the discussion of labeling should only be open if these labels are based on adequate risk assessments.
Yeah, you've got a good point. Trusted sources must be used to deliver the message.
Yeah, and not to toot our own horn, but I think we're pretty trustworthy, wouldn't you say?
Well, I've lost all of my trust in your abilities to deliver a decent joke, but if we're just talking science, yeah, we've totally got you covered.
Okay, well, honestly, I'm comfortable agreeing with you there.
Okay, so I would say this is probably a pretty good time to wrap up then.
Okay, yeah. Well, to sum up, extensive data exists to support improving food production output via genetic engineering compared to conventional production technologies.
And this knowledge has contributed to making genetically engineered foods safer and more sustainable.
However, regulation of biotechnologies is significantly more stringent than regulation of conventional analogs, creating a barrier to development and use of these newer technologies.
The precautionary principle, for example, which guides approaches to food technologies in Europe, has a negative impact on the use of genetic engineering technologies worldwide, like we talked about with the Fortuna potato, for example. Risk-based approaches are better suited to biotechnologies.
So, if the notable benefits afforded by biotechnology to agriculture and crop development around the world are to continue, it's critical that the unfavorable perceptions of these technologies held by the public and policymakers be changed, and pretty fast.
Ultimately, food, water, and energy resources are finite, and Dr. Newell McLaughlin argues that true sustainability can come only from an enlightened philosophy that promotes the development of technologies that minimize our use of these limited resources.
So, after this episode, we would love for you to join the conversation and tell us what you think.
Make sure to check out the conversation and let us know your thoughts via our Twitter page at ISGP Forum or on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
Thanks so much for tuning in today and, of course, for socializing with science.
We'll catch you next time, right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.